today about a certain category of human beings that I call radically cognitively, hey Mark, radically cognitively limited human beings. I have coined that really ugly phrase in an effort to try to avoid a number of problems. I don't want to encroach on any pre-existing categories, technical categories. I used to refer to this class of human beings by a term that turned out to have a technical meaning of which I was unaware. I'm also trying to avoid certain presuppositions that other terms have. And what I mean by radically cognitively limited human beings is human beings whose psychological capacities and potential are no higher than those of certain non-human animals. So you can pick whatever class of non-human animals you like. Let's say, for our purposes, radically cognitively limited human beings are human beings with psychological capacities and potential no higher than those of the higher non-human animals, maybe great apes, or lower than those. And I want to discuss today their moral status. Now, there's a question that comes up sometimes, which is, why should we consider the moral status of these human beings? It's a very sensitive and controversial issue. It's upsetting to a lot of people to discuss the moral status of these human beings. It's very upsetting to those who are closely, personally related to a human being who fits into this category. So I've been asked by people who are identified with the disabilities community, why I would want to raise the issue of the moral status of these human beings. Am I deliberately trying to make things bad for these people? And the answer, there are several answers to the question. I can say, one person asked me, why did I ever want to start thinking about this in the first place? And the answer to that is that many years ago, actually, when I was a graduate student here at Oxford, I began to think about the moral status of the human fetus, human zygotes, embryos. And what I discovered was you cannot compartmentalize your thinking about certain classes of being. As you raise the issue about the moral status of human fetuses, you're dealing already with members of the human species who are biologically the progeny of other human beings whose cognitive capacities are very low or non-existent. And it's very, you can't wall that issue off from questions about adult human beings or older members of the human species who are psychologically comparable to late-term fetuses. You simply can't separate those issues. Now, one of the venues at which I was asked this question repeatedly, why are you doing this, was a venue in which most of the people present were what in the United States is called pro-choice feminists. That is, they had liberal views about abortion but thought it was outrageous to raise the question about the status of adult human beings with perhaps comparable psychological capacities. So I think that our views about abortion, embryonic stem cell research, infanticide, selective non-treatment of defective newborn infants, our answers to these questions, our thinking about the status of these beings, may very well have implications for our views about radically cognitively limited adult human beings or children. and vice versa. That is, if you have certain views about radically cognitively limited human beings, really, in fact, the common sense view about the nature and status of radically cognitively limited human beings, you may very well have to revise your beliefs about abortion. I think a lot of people think that there's not a dilemma here, because we can salvage liberal beliefs about abortion by appealing to arguments that have nothing to say about the moral status of the fetus. The best known of those arguments, in fact all the others I think are just variations on this argument, is the argument given by Judith Thompson in a very famous article in the early 1970s, which makes the status of, which makes the permissibility of abortion depend on the idea that the fetus is dependent on the use of the woman's body as a life support system for its own survival. And Thompson claims this is not a service that a woman is morally required to provide for the fetus. It doesn't have a right to that service for 9 months from the woman. And I've come to believe that there's a pretty decisive and simple objection to that argument, which is that in any circumstances in which you think that argument plausibly justifies abortion, it can also equally justify the infliction of serious non-lethal injuries on the fetus, which would have the effect of causing a person to be harmed throughout his or her adult life. And that's because, I'll give you the argument very briefly here, you didn't come to hear this, but I'll tell it very briefly anyway. And that's because whenever you think it's permissible for the woman to kill the fetus, because keeping it in her body is for some reason against her interests, you have to concede that actually it would be better for the fetus to survive in an injured state than to die. It's better to have a life that involves some injury than not to have any life at all. So the woman can say, look, it's just the cost that the fetus has to pay for having the better of these two outcomes, namely a life rather than no life at all, is to accept whatever injury results, whatever problems result from the injury that I'm going to inflict on the fetus in pursuit of my own interests. I don't see any way that Thompson can avoid that conclusion. So I don't think that we can actually save liberal beliefs about abortion by appealing to these arguments that don't focus on the moral status of the fetus. So there's one really good reason for thinking about the status of radically cognitively limited human beings, and that is that we really can't be confident of our beliefs about abortion until we do. There's another good reason for thinking about the moral status of these human beings, and that is that if, as most people suppose, they share our high moral status, then it can't be the case that our moral status has its foundation in our higher psychological capacities, which is what I think most of us think. When I teach undergraduate classes on ethics and bioethics, I sometimes ask my students, tell me what it is about us that makes it more seriously objectionable morally to kill one of us than it is to kill a squirrel outside the window. And to my surprise, my students never say, oh, because we're made in the image of God, or we're God's property, or we have immortal souls and they don't, or something like that. They always say, well, yeah, it's because we're self-conscious, we can use language, we know the difference between right and wrong, we can act on the basis of reasons, and that's, you know, or have free will, is the way they put it. They always appeal to psychological capacities, and I think that shows that most of us really intuitively think that that's the basis of the fundamental difference between ourselves and lower non-human animals, is that we have these psychological capacities and so on that they don't have. But if radically cognitively limited human beings have our status, then that common intuition really can't be right, or at least there are kind of multiplicity of bases of status like ours. And of course, a final reason for thinking about the status of these human beings, which is, you know, one way in which these human beings pop up in philosophical arguments, is that they force us to rethink our views about animals. Most of us think, for example, that it would be permissible painlessly to kill a higher non-human animal, some kind of non-human primate, a chimpanzee or something of that sort, if it were possible to save the life of a human child by transplanting the chimpanzee's organs into the body of the child. It's actually been tried with baboons, it's failed, and so on. But you know, if we knew how to do it, if we could overcome the problems of immunological rejection, we'd be doing it all the time. These problems would of course be lesser problems if we chose to use for transplantation the organs of severely or radically cognitively limited human beings, but nobody supposes that that would be permissible. Why? What's the difference? So there's a challenge to important beliefs that we have that are relevant to bioethics here. So what I'm going to do today is to raise some questions for us to discuss. I'm going to make a few arguments, but I just want to raise some questions and see what you think about them. So I want to engage in discussion with you. Julian, the session is over at 2?
It's 2, yeah.
And how long should I go?
Normally we go for 45,
it's good.
50 minutes.
Sounds right. No, I'll aim for that. You know, give me a prod if I need it to stop. Now, one question we might think about is this: would it be wrong, knowingly or even intentionally, to cause such a human being to exist rather than a cognitively normal human being? Let me put that question in outrageous form for you. I'll put it in the form in which Francis Cam put it to me. Would it be okay deliberately to genetically induce these properties in one's own child because one would want such a human being to have around sort of like a pet? You wanted to have a really highly dependent child, one that would stay. Maybe you like babies or animals that stay permanently kind of infantile, like very cheerful dogs or something like that. And you might want to have such a child who just remain permanently like an infant. Would it be permissible to do that? And if not, why not? If a zygote or a fetus or an infant is found to be radically cognitively limited, to have, underdeveloped cerebral hemispheres, and we had the ability genetically, by genetic means, to enhance this individual's psychological capacities, and in particular cognitive capacities, would we have a moral reason to do that? Would we have a moral obligation to do that? And if so, why? If there's an adult human being who's radically cognitively limited, that is, whose cognitive capacities are comparable to those of some non-human animal, would it be a good idea to use genetic means to enhance this individual's cognitive capacities up to something like the normal level, average level IQ or above? And if so, what would the reason be, and what might the constraints be on this? I have some views about that. I think one constraint might be a kind of, or not really a constraint, but a restriction on the strength of the reason to enhance in the case of an adult, would be that the difference between the radically cognitively limited human being before the enhancement and that same individual after the enhancement, the psychological distance between them would be so great that it's very hard to see why the individual at the beginning could have a very strong interest in acquiring those higher capacities. That is, this would involve enormous and radical psychological discontinuity. It might even involve the kind of psychological discontinuity of a sort that would prompt someone like Derek Parfit to say these aren't the same individual at all. There's too much psychological discontinuity between them. So it's what you'd actually be doing is causing one individual to cease to exist and bringing another individual into existence on certain views about personal identity. That wouldn't be my view. I think it would be the same individual. But I hold a view similar to Parfit's about what matters in survival. And I think that if you take that view, you would see that there's not much reason for the sake of the individual at the time to provide that enhancement. Though you would be giving, on my view, one and the same individual a much better life from a whole life point of view. Now, there are, of course, contingent reasons why we would want to enhance these individuals, and those are pretty obvious. I didn't mention them. I should probably say that to preempt an objection here. Clearly, most parents would want this enhancement for their own child, and the social costs of providing the enhancement might be less than the social costs of supporting the life of a permanently dependent human being. So it might be personal and social reasons for wanting to provide the enhancement. My question was really about whether there are reasons or obligations to enhance these individuals for their own sake. Now, of course, I think most people's intuition is yes, that we should provide this for these individuals. This would be doing something that would be very good for them. Of course, if it's a zygote or a fetus, we're then saying, you know, there's a reason to provide the zygote or fetus with a really good life, a better life, and so on. That kind of reason may conflict with people's beliefs about the morality of abortion. And there's another problem with saying that we have a very strong reason to provide the enhancement for these individuals. Another concern about that is that if we think that there is, then we have to explain the common view that there is no comparable reason, no such reason at all, to enhance the psychological capacities of non-human animals. I guess I don't really know anybody who thinks that we have a moral reason to gather in the squirrels outside the building and enhance their cognitive capacities if we could. We tend to think it's, you know, it's fine for squirrels to stay squirrels. Now, what most people will say about that challenge is, look, it's not a misfortune for a squirrel to have the psychological capacities of a squirrel, but it is a misfortune for a human being to have the psychological capacities of a radically cognitively limited human being. In other words, these human beings are the victims of a terrible misfortune. They are disabled, whereas a squirrel is not disabled. Well, why do we think that they are victims of a misfortune? Why do we suppose that these individuals are disabled? Well, one thing is, of course, that they are dependent. That is, on certain concepts or models of disability, they are disadvantaged in our environment because they are incapable of taking care of themselves. And that's not true of animals. Animals are equipped with instincts that enable them to survive, even with very low cognitive capacities. They're programmed to be able to go around and gather up nuts and stick them in trees for when it gets cold and that kind of thing. But these human beings are not. And so people conclude, because they're dependent, they are unfortunate. They are disabled in a way that requires us to respond to this. Just one worry about that response, I think, is that small children are comparably dependent. They can't take care of themselves. And yet, we don't think that children are the victims of a grave misfortune for being children. Or I should say, because Richard Kraut is here, that only Aristotle thought that. There are passages, I mean, I should acknowledge, show off my scholarship here. There are passages in Aristotle in which Aristotle says, you know, to be a child is to be in a very bad state. No one would ever want to return to that state. Even if one appreciated all the delights and pleasures of being a child, you still wouldn't want to return to that state. So we recognize that's actually a bad state to be in. But I don't think most of us believe that. The common sense view about this is that childhood is this glorious, halcyon state that's really wonderful, and we all like to go back to it. So we don't think that children are kind of these unfortunate beings who are temporarily disabled, and we're just kind of waiting for them to overcome their disabilities. We think, well, you know, it's a wonderful state to be in. So the dependency claim doesn't look decisive. Why is it wonderful to be childlike for a while, but not forever? Okay, so there's a puzzle. I don't think I know the answer to that, but I haven't heard anybody give an answer to that that I have found very persuasive. So it's an interesting problem. What most people want to say here is that how well off or badly off we are is really a function of some kind of comparison with the norm for members of our species. They want to say, forget about the dependency stuff. The reason why radically cognitively limited human beings are unfortunate and squirrels aren't isn't because they're dependent. It is because they're falling short of the norm for well-being and for capacity and so on for members of their kind. Well, I've tried to say a good bit about that in stuff that I've published in the past, but let me add a couple of reflections to what I've said in the past. And there are very few of you who know what I've said about that in the past, and that's okay, but I don't want to bore those who do know what I've said in the past about that. One of the things that I haven't said in print is that the norm for psychological capacity for our species has been quite variable over time. I don't know when scientists say roughly the first human beings emerged in the course of history. But I'm pretty confident that those first human beings, whenever it was they existed, had psychological capacities that were probably closer to those of higher non-human animals now than they are to our psychological capacities now. But they are regarded as members of our species. So we have this tremendous variability within the norm for psychological capacity within our species, and indeed the norm for capacity for well-being within our species. That is, our higher psychological capacities, I think, provide us with a capacity for experiencing dimensions of well-being that are not at all accessible to higher non-human animals, and that weren't accessible to our remotest ancestors either, our remotest human ancestors. Either. So, for us, what makes our lives different from and higher than those of non-human animals is that we can experience and participate in very close personal relations based on deep sympathy and intimacy, deep mutual understanding between persons. This is not accessible to beings without these higher psychological capacities for understanding what is going on in other people's minds at the deepest level. Achieving difficult and very valuable goals is something that is accessible to us, but wasn't accessible to our remotest human ancestors. Certain forms of aesthetic appreciation and creation, possible for us, but not possible for them, and so on. So there is this variability over time that casts some doubt on our appeals to the norms for members of the human species. There's also, as I just noted when I referred to children, variability in psychological capacity over the course of a single human lifetime. When we say these radically cognitively limited human beings aren't doing so well by reference to the norms for the human species, what we mean is norms for adult human beings. They may be doing perfectly well by the norms for well-being for a newborn infant. So why do we pick the adult level? Well, not really sure. Maybe what I think most people probably believe is something like this, that we should make a series of comparisons here to understand how well or badly off an individual is. We should make comparisons that are first indexed to species and secondly indexed to stage of life for a member of the species. So we say of radically cognitively limited human beings when they're infants, well, they're not doing so badly as infants. It's when they get older, they're doing very badly as human adults because they just don't have access to these dimensions of higher dimensions of well-being that I mentioned before. They can be contented and so on. But that's all. You might think that's intuitively plausible, but if you accept that solution to the problem, there is a cost. And that cost is this, that a certain degree of age-related decline is characteristic of extreme old age in human beings. That is, it's the norm for the species that we get weaker and less energetic, and in many cases a bit mentally feeble and so on. And we all think that this is a misfortune. We'd rather stay robust and strong and alert and so on. So we do think it's a misfortune that at the latest stages of human life, there's often some decline. But if we have this age index norm for the species, we can't really say that. I mean, that's, you know, if that's the norm, that's good. But we recognize it as a decline. Now I'm going to go back, really, to one of the things I was saying earlier. When I started off, I asked the question, why is it important to think about the moral status of these human beings? What's the significance of this? Well, there is a problem here. It's one that I don't know of anybody who has actually raised this issue as a serious issue in bioethics. So I'm going to raise it today and see what you think. The question is this. How important is it morally to preserve the life of a radically cognitively limited human being who has medical problems that would otherwise be fatal? This isn't a question about how important it is to provide medical treatments for radically cognitively limited human beings for conditions that would cause suffering or discomfort or anything like that. It's a question about how important is it to preserve their lives. Now, This is, again, a very sensitive question, so I apologize in advance if some of you find it very painful to think about this issue. Many people do, and I'm not trying to upset anybody. I'm just trying to raise issues that I think it's important for us to think about, because there really is an issue here that at some point we ought to confront. Now, obviously, I, maybe not obviously to everyone, but I believe that we have very important moral reasons to preserve the lives of these individuals for the sake of those who are closely, personally related to them. Saving their lives is very important to their parents, and therefore it should be very important for everybody else. But very often, these individuals outlive their parents by a number of years, and they don't themselves have offspring. Remember, they are radically cognitively limited. They don't have relationships with other people, sexual relationships. So sometimes there are these individuals who continue to exist in institutional settings, who have no close personal relations and no close friends, because they don't really establish friendships of the sort that we do. If we devote life-saving resources to preserving their lives, we may be denying life-saving resources to other human beings. These are scarce resources. We don't live in a world of unlimited medical resources so that we can, provide very expensive treatments for radically cognitively limited human beings and provide all the treatments that would prevent people in Africa from dying of malaria and AIDS and save the lives of other people who need very expensive life-saving technologies in our own society. We don't save all the people in the world that we could save. Everybody knows that. We don't even save all the people in our own societies whom we could save. But we do often devote resources to saving radically cognitively limited human beings. Our intuitions about whom it's morally necessary to save, I think, are very mixed and confused. We do have intensive care units for prematurely born infants. We spend an awful lot of money sometimes on saving the lives of infants born, sometimes even prior to the onset of the capacity for consciousness. We can actually keep alive infants now who are at a stage in physical maturation where the brain hasn't even progressed to the point where consciousness is possible. We sometimes spend an awful lot of money trying to keep those infants alive. Dom Wilkinson in the back has a really wonderful paper on these issues about how important it is to have different types of intensive care units. Dom asks, would we really want to have intensive care units for embryos? No, we don't have that. What about intensive care units for fetuses in utero? Once they're outside the womb, then we give them intensive care. But on the other hand, we also selectively allow some infants to die, even some who are not born prematurely but are born with certain defects. We make a decision to allow some of them to die. Particularly, and the reason is that the cost, not just the financial cost, but the emotional cost and cost in time and opportunity costs for the parents are just too great. So we do allow considerations of cost to affect decisions about preserving lives in the case of infants. So these are real issues. What's more, I mean, you can throw this in too if you want to. Throw this into the equation. Sometimes, in the case of a radically cognitively limited human being, an adult has no close personal relations living at all. If we were to allow that individual to die, that individual's organs would be healthy and could be provided for transplantation to actually save the lives of other human beings. So the cost of saving the life of a radically cognitively limited human being who will otherwise die, who requires expensive treatment, is not just that we'll be devoting very expensive and scarce medical resources to the preservation of the life, but we may also be preserving the life beyond a point at which the organs could be usable for transplantation, so that other people may die in some sense as a consequence of the preservation of this life. Okay, I was going to say something about posthumous interests of parents, but I think I shouldn't go into that. We can bring that up in the discussion, because I haven't said anything much about enhancement yet, and what I would like to do at this point is to use a kind of thought experiment about the possibilities of genetic enhancement to help us think about the moral status of the radically cognitively limited. Now, a lot of us believe that there is a sense in which all of us in this room, many people say all human beings, all persons or whatever, are morally inviolable. This is something that you hear Kantians say and other non-consequentialists, that we have a certain kind of inviolability that restricts the ways in which other people may treat us. As Kant says, we can't be treated merely as means to the ends of others. There are other ways in which we are inviolable. But actually, let's focus on that. We could ask, what's meant by saying a person is inviolable? Well, one important thing that is meant, and I'll just kind of focus on this today, what's meant is that it's not permissible to sacrifice a human being for the sake of another. And let's keep it at that level, at the higher level of sacrifice. It's not permissible, let's say, intentionally to kill one human being to save the lives of other human beings. That's one of the implications or one of the corollaries of our notion or our sense that we are morally inviolable. And I think the common sense view is that the radically cognitively limited share our inviolability. As I suggested earlier, we would be perfectly happy, I think, virtually all of us, to sacrifice the lives of chimpanzees or gorillas or whatever if we could use their organs to save the lives of human persons. I think we would do that. And we're not willing to do that with radically cognitively limited human beings who have comparable psychological capacities and potential to those of the animals that we would sacrifice. So the intuition is we have a kind of inviolability that animals don't, and radically cognitively limited human beings share that inviolability. Well, the people who say that we're inviolable usually don't really mean it in the strict and literal sense, because very few moral philosophers now are literally absolutists in their views. There are some absolutists around. Most of the remaining absolutists in the world or in our world are Catholics, Catholic Christians. A certain kind of absolutism is still the norm for Catholics, but very few other people have such a view. I actually think that absolutism is exceedingly difficult to defend. I think really impossible to defend coherently. There are a lot of arguments for that, but let me just give you one argument that's quite simple, that will enable you to see the problems that absolutism faces. Let's focus actually on torture, because this is the only form of action that I can think of that a large number of non-Catholic people believe is absolutely impermissible. I know a lot of philosophers who are not absolutists about anything except torture. They will say, and in print, torture is absolutely prohibited, absolutely impermissible. There are no possible circumstances in which torture could be permissible. Now, here's the problem with that view, or any view of that sort about any form of treatment, but it's nice to focus on torture, partly because it illustrates quite nicely the problem. And it's also the idea that there's an absolute prohibition on torture is something that a lot of people are really disposed to believe. Okay, so we have to understand what torture is. So suppose whatever it is, we have some notion that beyond a certain threshold, in the intentional infliction of a certain level of suffering, above that threshold, for an instrumental purpose, counts as torture. So we have to have some threshold there. I mean, if I just, I want to get information from you, and I pinch you repeatedly, or say unkind things to you repeatedly, that's not torture. So we have to have some lower bound to what counts as torture. So let's say we've got our threshold here. We say anything above that threshold counts as torture. We combine that with the view torture is absolutely impermissible. Then we say nothing can justify the infliction of suffering above this threshold on a person. But there's a level right below that threshold that, remember now, it's not torture. It's only imperceptibly less than torture, or barely perceptibly less than torture. And what I have to say then is that there is some goal for which I could permissibly inflict that level of suffering on somebody. But I couldn't inflict the suffering at the next level up for any possible goal, even a goal a million times more important than the one that I could permissibly pursue by means of the thing that's just below the threshold for torture. This is why I think you can't have one of the reasons why I think that you really can't have a coherent absolutist view. So if you accept something like that, then you really probably don't believe that we are viable, are inviolable. Most people believe that there's some number of innocent human beings such that it would be permissible intentionally to kill one innocent human being to prevent all those other innocent human beings either from being wrongfully killed or tortured forever or whatever. Okay? So we don't think that we're literally inviolable. It's a matter here of kind of numbers. What we think really is that there are degrees of viability. It's not that we're all utilitarians. It's not that we're all consequentialists or something. We do believe that there are degrees of viability. And what we believe is that we have the lowest degree of viability, or put the other way, we have the highest degree of inviolability of all those beings of which we are aware. So we have a certain kind of inviolability. You can't sacrifice one person to save another five, intentionally anyway. You can't intentionally sacrifice one person as a means of saving the lives of five. But there's some number of people whose lives we could save such that it would become permissible to intentionally to kill one human being to save that number, however great it might be. But now imagine that we have technologies for genetic, psychological, and cognitive enhancement. And imagine that we could create in our immediate progeny beings with psychological capacities that would exceed our own by more than ours exceed those of the highest non-human animals. So I'm asking you, imagine the psychological distance between the highest non-human animals and ourselves, those of us in this room, and then imagine that our immediate progeny get enhanced so that they are higher than we are in relevant respects by more than we are higher than these animals. I wonder if the presence of such beings in our world would affect our viability. In the following sense, it might be permissible for somebody to kill me, not to save two or three other human beings, but, you know, to save 1,000 or 10,000 or 1,000,000, something like that. It would be permissible for somebody intentionally to kill me to save all these other people. If we had these higher post-human beings, might be permissible to kill me to save one of them, or two, maybe, you know. So in a relative sense, I would have become more viable in the presence of these new beings. So consideration of these post-humans suggests that our inviolability is in some sense comparative. Now here's the controversial claim. It might well be that there's not any single threshold on the scale that measures psychological capacity above which all individuals have exactly the same moral status. Right now, I think most of us do operate with some kind of threshold notion. Some people say, okay, this something about us, something special about us that puts us above a kind of threshold below which all non-human animals lie. And there's just this one threshold, and any individual who has whatever it is that makes us special has the same moral status that we have. So, for example, if we think that the relevant kind of property that we have is something to do with our psychological capacities, if you think, for example, with Kant, that it's our rational nature that elevates us above animals, you might think, as most people who hold any view of this sort do, that variations in the degree to which one possesses that capacity don't make any difference above the threshold. It's kind of, for moral purposes, it's all or nothing. So if you think it's rational nature or humanity, as Kant says, that is the basis of our moral status, then, you know, some of us are more rational than others, some of us have a more highly developed rational nature than others, some of us are more responsive to reasons than others, and so on. But most people would say, that doesn't matter. Variations in the relevant capacity don't matter. All that matters is that you have it. So if these post-humans would have it to vastly greater degree than we do, that doesn't matter. They would still have the same moral status that we do. That's a possible view. But you might also imagine that these creatures, that there's some other capacity, kind of like rational nature or self-consciousness or whatever it is that we think sets the threshold. Imagine there's some other threshold up there that makes their lives even, you know, that makes them, gives them a further higher status. I can't tell you what it is. I'm not smart enough to figure it out. I'm below that threshold, so I don't know. I mean, this is beginning to sound like a kind of theological argument to me, so I'm not sure how much weight to give to this suggestion, since I can't tell you what the other threshold would be. But it's a possibility that actually there's not one threshold, and that there are more thresholds, or that inviolability is in some way essentially comparative. So that if there were these post-humans, and by the way, one further thought here is that if you think that species membership matters to moral status, as most people intuitively do, then it would become a very important question for you in determining what the moral status of these post-humans would be, whether or not they are human beings, whether or not they're members of our species, or whether we would have created a new species by creating these people. Now, to me, I can't see how that could possibly make any difference. You know, I know what their properties are, you know, insofar as I can understand what it means to say that their cognitive capacities would be this much higher than ours. But do I really need to ask myself, well, would I really need to go consult a biologist to tell me what the moral status of these individuals was and to tell me what my moral status was vis-a-vis them to tell, you know, to determine for me whether they're members of our species? So that there's a question for you to think about. If we were to create such progeny for ourselves, would their moral status be crucially dependent on the answer to a question that only a biologist could answer?
So you asked me to prod you.
Yep, I'm finished. So what I was going to say was, we think that we think there's a case to be made for thinking that if there were such post-humans, we might have an intermediate status between theirs and that of animals. We might have sort of three levels now. And if that might be your view, if you think that would be a plausible view to take of ourselves in a world in which there were beings who were higher than we are, by more than we're higher than animals, then you might conclude that the status of radically cognitively limited individuals, in some respects, perhaps with respect to the value of life, is intermediate between our status and that of lower animals. Now you'd have to make the same claim about comparably endowed animals. We might revise our thinking in that way to think that there are already three levels. You know, ours, our level, lower animals, and an intermediate level. Okay, now I really am finished.
I have permission, but it's always bad form for the chair to ask the first question, so I'm happy to get out of the line if other people have questions. Yep.
You said earlier on that it was difficult to define the disability in terms of dependency because children and very old people may have similar tendency, but surely the difference is that they are permanently dependent, whereas children and very old people are not.
I would say that it would seem odd to me to define disability by reference to permanence. Do we ever say of somebody who has a condition that can actually be cured, that they're temporarily disabled? Do we award those little parking permits to people who are temporarily disabled? Then I think we should have a notion of temporarily disabled that would contrast with permanently disabled. And if we treated dependency as a criterion of permanent disability, then we would want to say of children that they are temporarily disabled because they're temporarily dependent. So I question the idea that dependency can be the criterion of disability.
Go through childhood, as it were, whereas not everyone is permanently a child, childlike. So, I know it's difficult, but just intuitively it seems that you can't say a child is disabled because everyone goes through that process.
But right, well, suppose we have some people who are clearly disabled. You don't even have to think about cognitively disabled people. Somebody who has some physical disability, and they're 30 years old, and they've always been called disabled, and they've always had this little thing. And then we find a cure or a way to fix it that we didn't have before. Maybe it's genetic. Maybe we insert a little gene, and suddenly, bingo, they're no longer disabled. Now they've gotten over it. So do we say, we were mistaken? They weren't disabled when they had this problem because it wasn't permanent.
No, I'm not saying that you can only be disabled if it's permanent. I'm just saying the difference with the severely cognitively limited humans is that they are permanent.
Right. So I think what you're saying really is that you know, they're disabled relative to the norm for a human life. So it's another version of the kind of we assess disability by reference to what's normal for our members of our species. And that's what I had the other objections to.
Well, can I just ask my question then, because it's exactly on this topic. So Guy Kahane and I have this account of disability, okay, which doesn't make it refer to species typical normal functioning. What it says, a state of biology or psychology that tends to reduce somebody's well-being in a given set of social or natural circumstances is a disability. So when you compare squirrels to children with intellectual disability or people with intellectual disability and normal children, it's only the Down syndrome people who are disabled on this account. And it goes like this, that the relevant norm is not the species typical norm. It's one that is realistically achievable, and that you have a claim in terms of distributive justice for the relevant intervention. So the reason why a squirrel...
You surely don't want to build the notion of distributive justice into your concept of disability, do you?
Well, if you take the squirrel, are we going to say that squirrels are disabled if there are some cognitive enhancers that are available that will increase their intelligence to that of a normal human being? I don't think it makes sense to say the squirrel is necessarily disabled. It's still an open question whether they're disabled. But in the case of the Down syndrome child, it's realistically achievable that there would be some cure, there could be some treatment, and that individual would have the IQ of a normal... I'll give you another example.
But wait a minute. Why? Suppose we had some genetic intervention that could enhance the cognitive capacities of a human being with Down syndrome. I mean, unlikely, but why suppose we couldn't have precisely parallel drug that would do the same for a squirrel? I mean, once we know how to do it in human beings, we can probably figure out from that point on how to do it for dogs,
way,
for example.
The ordinary way that we view disabled humans is that they could somehow be normal, could somehow be similar to us. So we'll give you the case of that encephalitis lethargica. Here were people who were just asleep. They had
They had already been persons, so it's a bit...
At that point in time, they have no capacity, no mental capacity whatsoever.
No, that's not true.
It is true. they had no capability.
Of course they had the capacity, because some of them, when given L-dopamine or whatever it was, woke up and talked to people. So of course they were capable. All the capacities were there registered in their neurological tissues.
So too would a child with some sort of brain abnormality.
It's congenital. It's not all registered there in the tissues just waiting to be activated. The capacity is the registration in the tissues of the brain of these abilities.
But say we had a child with a disability, that we looked like a child with Down syndrome, but suddenly we discovered if we go to L-DOPA to this child, the child became normal. We'd still have described the child previously as disabled.
But you wouldn't, if this child had been, suppose we have a child who's been very severely cognitively diminished or impaired from conception on, and then what you suppose you give this child whatever chemical this is, and suddenly the capacities are there, you're going to have somebody, or something like, the potential is there for the development of the capacity. You're going to have somebody you're going to have an individual with the mental capacities of a fetus, a late-term fetus, because nothing is going to have been happening in that brain for however long this individual has been alive. In other words, you give the L-dopamine to this individual who has, let's say, hasn't been able to talk or anything of that sort, not suddenly going to be able to talk. Or, you know, understand anything in the world is going to be like a normal 1 hour old human infant, and then it's going to have to develop and mature. It's not at all the same. I just think if you bring in the people with encephalitis lethargica, you're bringing in a case that's not relevant, because these are people who are ordinary persons like ourselves who've. Who are given kind of indefinite total anesthesia, So, and we don't want to say that a person who's under total anesthesia for an operation now has the capacities, has capacities lower than those of a squirrel. It's just not true.
Well, I won't keep going with this, but take two infants, one normal infant and one that's just been born as a result of a birth injury, okay, and is going to be disabled, profound spastic quadriparesis and whatever, intellectual impairment. In the one case, we say this: we have a normal infant that's not disabled, and in the other case, we say we have a disabled infant. So I can't see how what you're referring to is it is possible that that disabled infant could have some reasonable expectation of an intervention that would return to the state that it could undergo normal development. So yep. Isn't that simply referring not to permanence but to the realistic possibility that you could give that individual an opportunity for an ordinary human life with its prospects?
Realistic possibility, I think, refers to what I call intrinsic potential. That is, everything's there waiting to be kind of activated by some minimal external intervention. I also think, again, that cases involving mere physical disability are totally, they raise totally different issues from the issues that I'm trying to address in the talk today. Most people, see, the problem, the reason that I don't say radically cognitively disabled human beings, but instead I say radically cognitively limited human beings is, I think it's an open question whether these human beings are actually disabled. I don't even know exactly what it means to say that someone is disabled. I don't even really care about the application of that term, whether we call them disabled or not. But there is this that I think is a problem, that is that we do have a pretty clear category of human beings we refer to as disabled who have a physical disability. And physical disabilities raise a number of interesting issues about justice and so on. I think the issues raised by radical cognitive limitation are of a completely different order. They raise totally different questions. They raise questions about moral status that aren't raised by people with physical disabilities. And that's why I worry about the use of the term disability in this context, because people do tend to assimilate these categories together as if they were all of a kind or all of a piece. So if you're a disabilities advocate, you want to defend the rights of people in wheelchairs, and you want to defend the rights of people with other kinds of disabilities, and you want to say things about people who are deaf and blind and so on, but you'll also feel called upon to come to the defense of human beings whose only problem isn't, you know, everything physically works fine. So only problem is that they have the mental level of a non-human animal, or below the level of a non-human animal. And they say, okay, this is a disabled person too. This is a person, a human being who has rights just like everybody else. So they bring the two categories together. And I just think that's a terrible mistake. There are different moral issues that are raised here. So in a way, the concept of disability isn't what I'm after here.
I want to keep going. Did you want to say something on this?
Did you want to do this?
Okay, so I've got a line. So I think you're the expert.
You mentioned the view that cognitive enhancement in adults may not be in the interest of a person P if the psychological distance between P before and P after the treatment is too large, because P ceases to exist. And I happen to share that view. Could we make a kind of similar argument for fetuses? For example, by saying that a fetus before treatment has a certain genetic makeup and has a certain developmental trajectory which leads it towards, let's say, a life with severe cognitive limitations. And after the treatment, it has a different genetic makeup and it also has a different developmental trajectory. And if that developmental trajectory is too radically different from the one before the treatment, then we're not actually talking about the same fetus any longer, which means that it would also not be in the interest of the fetus to treat it in a certain way.
Good. You see, I actually think it is confirmation of the claim that it's not, that a radically cognitively limited human being does not have a strong personal interest in having or undergoing radical cognitive enhancement. It's a confirmation of that intuition that many of us have the same belief about a fetus. If it were really strongly in the fetus's interest, now as a fetus, to develop into a cognitively normal human being, then we'd have a really powerful argument against abortion. It would be Don, if those of you who know the abortion literature, it would be Don Marquis's argument against abortion. He says, you know, it's a terrible thing to lose a valuable future life that would be yours. So a fetus has this strong interest in having its later life as a person. If that were true, Marquis's argument would be a good argument. But it's not a good argument because fetuses in their present state don't have a strong interest in living to acquire their own future life as a person. And I think the best explanation for that is that there is this radical psychological discontinuity between the fetus and the later person. So I don't think that we have a strong reason for the sake of a fetus to, for the sake of a radically cognitively limited human fetus, to administer to it a genetic therapy to give it a normal future, because if we had that strong reason, we'd have a strong reason not to abort fetuses.
Hello?
My question was related to your point earlier, Julian, just the question of how do we know that there is, how can we ever be sure that there's no chance of being able to enhance or improve the cognitive ability of a person? How can we ever be sure that there's not going to be some discovery we make that would allow us to give them more function? Well, we were talking about permanence, so I think my question is really...
Yeah, I don't think that we can. The question is, I guess, the moral question is, how important is it to keep them alive because of that prospect? And what I'm just saying about the fetus is, I don't think it, you know, that prospect is important in this particular case. I guess I would want to say, I think that we could have the same kind of reason to provide cognitive enhancement for a fetus that we would have to choose preconception, prior to conception, to bring into existence a cognitively normal human being rather than a radically cognitively limited human being. I take that to be that there is such a reason, but I think it's an impersonal kind of reason and not a person-affecting reason, or not primarily a person-affecting reason.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Those issues aside, I think what you suggest about being there being this possible series of levels of moral status is very interesting. I just wonder whether you thought about, if that occurred, how in a society or whatever you would call a group of sentient species, what might we need to try to manage that?
How we would sort of get on socially with our progeny, who would be so much superior to ourselves. I have no idea. You know, I'm afraid we'd have to leave it to them. because they would soon take charge. I don't know how quickly they would develop. If they were really magnificent, you know, it might be by the age of two they would be way beyond us. But might be very quick. They'd take over very quickly. And we just have to leave it to them, because we couldn't offer them any advice that would be worth their attention.
You said that you're essentially after the concept of disability, really. And then you make a distinction between cognitive limited and physical disabilities. And then you created those at least three levels of moral status. The progeny, ourselves, say, Homo sapiens, and other primates, etc. But there are several issues there, actually. One, I'm not clear whether there is a distinction and a separability between the physical disabilities and cognitive limitations. That's the first issue. This is related with the fact that we, in other species, we don't even know whether other species are lower to us in intelligence. Okay? For example, we know in biology, we may consider avian species to be of comparable intelligence to us. Okay? So there are issues in current biology which bring the issue of cognition. And again, there is the issue of communication, which the lady actually brought it up, which again is very important. And communication itself, at least for ourselves, for Homo sapiens, okay, clearly shows an inseparability between the physical and the cognitive. For Homo sapiens, communication shows an inseparability.
Oh, okay.
But I'll stop that.
Okay. On the third point, I agree entirely that all of our cognitive and psychological capacities are physically based. You know, I don't believe that there's separability between cognitive and physical. What I meant by physical disability was sort of purely physical, not affecting mental capacity, that's all. And I do think the one way in which I actually think that the difference between physical disability and cognitive incapacity is relevant in two ways. It's relevant to questions of status, which have been my subject in the talk today. But it's also relevant to capacity for well-being. That is, all the various dimensions of well-being that are accessible to all of us in this room are also accessible to anyone who has a merely physical disability. It's just that the physical disability may constitute an impediment to the realization of some of those capacities for well-being. But I think that in the case of cognitive disability or limitation, what's lacking is the capacity for certain dimensions of well-being. I think that's true with respect to animals. So although my dog is capable of personal relations of a very wonderful sort, he's not capable of personal relations that involve significant mutual comprehension and sympathy and understanding. And he's not capable of high levels of achievement or accomplishment, not capable of achieving knowledge or scientific discovery or artistic creation or whatever. Now, these are capacities that I think are important in some sense autonomous dimensions of well-being without which our lives would be greatly impoverished. So that's another reason for wanting to distinguish between physical disabilities and cognitive disabilities. That is, the physical disabilities are an impediment to the realization of a capacity for well-being that's there, whereas cognitive limitations are sometimes limitations to capacity for well-being itself. And on your middle point, I don't think that it's true that we don't know that some species don't have our level of psychological capacity. I think it is known that there are no animal species that have the sort of full range of our psychological capacities.
Yeah, but that's actually a crucial point.
It's true that animals have our, that some animals have our level of psychological capacity, then there goes my argument.
Well,
there goes my whole problem, really.
Yeah, it depends very much on the criteria we use, okay? And if we take, for example, the criteria of uniqueness for humans, okay? People say human language or whatever, and that's one. But uniqueness is something which we have discussed. I mean, other species have unique features.
Okay,
I'll give you one. Avian, again, species have unique features.
Okay.
Including feather or a respiratory and
I was referring to psychological capacity, not not physical capacity. And I should also say there are lots of psychological capacities that I think are of no particular significance to moral status. And everybody will tell you that. When I ask my students, what is it that separates us from animals, they don't just give me any old psychological capacity, like, you know, the ability to compute prime numbers or something like that. They say things like self-consciousness, ability to think about and plan for the future, to have desires and ambitions for a long-term future, the ability to deliberate and act on the basis of reasons for action, to be autonomous in the sense of directing one's life in accordance with one's own reflectively endorsed values and that kind of thing. Now, no animals do those things.
I mean, should we involve Roger?
Can I talk about squirrels?
You may.
So, I mean, you said you didn't know anybody who thinks there's a moral reason for enhancement, but I'm inclined to think there could be. And I can see why, if the enhancement in question is very radical, so that you give the squirrel a nut, and it eats this nut, and then it comes in, it immediately turns into a kind of squirrel person, and it can talk to you. That you might say there was no person affecting reason to give that squirrel the nut because the squirrel's now gone and you've got the squirrel person now.
Right.
But what's the objection to a more gradual process where over maybe a month or a year the squirrel turns into a squirrel person? And I'm not just what's the objection to it, but why shouldn't we do that? I think we probably should.
I was exaggerating for rhetorical purposes when I said nobody believes this, because I think Larry Temkin believes it, one of my colleagues at Rutgers, Roger knows well. I think I kind of believe it too, so I actually don't disagree with you there. I think it's implied by, I think Julian ought to believe it, because he has this principle of procreative beneficence, and I think that should have no inherent species boundary to it, so that it, I think on Julian's view, if I could spend my time breeding cattle or making babies, I should make babies. You know, if I can't do both, and I can bring a lot of cows into existence, or I can bring a lot of happy people into existence, I should bring the happy people into existence, and that's a direct implication of the principle of procreative beneficence. And I think it's also an implication of Derek's principle Q in Reasons in Persons, which is the what I call the impersonal comparative principle, which is something like this. If you, it's kind of like the procreative beneficence, I forget the exact way, but if you have a choice between causing a happier individual to exist and a less happy individual to exist, and if all other things are equal, you should cause the happier individual to exist. And given that cognitive enhancement of animals isn't something for which we have individual affecting reasons to do, it does seem to me to be something that these various principles imply that we have impersonal reason to do. I just think the impersonal reason isn't terribly strong, but I don't think that it's really plausible to deny that there is such a reason. You'd be giving the squirrel a better life, even though you wouldn't be doing the squirrel as it exists now any particular favors.
So to continue on this topic, I think you were moving slightly from the claim that higher cognitive capacities give the beings who have such capacities a higher moral standing, to then the claim that people who have those capacities can live a better life. And I think these are two different claims. And I see no reason, for instance, to think that squirrels are, on average, less happy than human beings. I mean, maybe they are, but it's not entirely clear, where it's obvious that we have much higher capacities than squirrels. So the reasons for enhancing a squirrel, if we do have such reasons, then we need to distinguish whether it's because, you know, these individuals will have a better quality of life, or instead for a different reason, that such individuals would have a higher moral standing. And it seems that when it comes to moral standing, that gives you reason not to do certain things to the people who already exist and who have this standing. But it doesn't seem to give you reason to create these people in the first place.
Good. That's excellent. I didn't mean to suggest that I think there's any necessary connection between high moral status and a high capacity for well-being. I do think there's a connection, but I didn't mean for anything to hinge on that. But what I thank you for is pointing out that there are two possible reasons for providing cognitive enhancement for a squirrel or for a cognitively deficient fetus or newborn infant or adult human being. And one is to give it a better life by enhancing its capacity for well-being, making accessible to it these various dimensions of well-being that it has no access to at the moment. And the other reason, which I didn't say anything about, is that you would be bringing about, you would be converting that individual into an individual with a higher kind of status. You'd be making it, in some sense, to employ the terminology of, you know, Hitler and others, a higher being. Now, do we have reasons to bring about the existence of higher beings rather than lower beings? I think most people think not, just because most people think it would be perfectly okay for me if I bred cows or whatever rather than had children. So they don't think if I'm going to cause new sentient beings to exist, I really have to bring the ones with the higher moral status into being rather than the ones with the lower moral status. I wonder if people think that it's a reason to provide cognitive enhancement for a human fetus that it would give the fetus a higher moral status. I think anybody who believes that abortion is permissible is probably committed to the idea that, ultimately, whether they realize it or not, probably committed to the idea that fetuses do have a lower moral status than adults have. So if you do think that there's a moral reason to give a fetus higher moral status, then you've got an objection to abortion. Not based on its present status, but based on the reason that comes from the possibility of raising the moral status of existing beings.
I think you're next. So, no, just in the front. And then you wrap up. So, thank you.
This is a question about species norms and biological considerations. So you mentioned sort of the point against the appeal to species norms and working out sort of misfortunes and disabilities. The fact that the species norms were varied throughout our evolutionary history, since the first Homo sapiens had the intellectual norm for them to lower than it is for us. I think one of the things that seems somewhat clear about people who appeal to species norms in literature on biologists is that they're often operating with a notion of species norm, which is in some sense non-statistical. They're appealing to an almost, I mean, they don't say explicitly, but there's almost kind of an idea of an Aristotelian essence or an Aristotelian ideal or a platonic ideal, the species. So of course, I mean, I think they're wrong to do this. I mean, it's one of the sort of consequences of modern biology that you can't describe groups of organisms except as statistical terms. Ernst Mayr stressed this a lot. So my question was kind of, well, the other point is that though sort of this is now sort of canon in biology, it's not something that many moral philosophers have caught on to. So for example, people who are neo-Aristotelians like Philip Foote and Rosamund Herschel still speak as if there's a non-statistical norm for the species which we can appeal to in making certain moral judgments. So I was wondering, say something about, to what degree do you think the sort of misconceptions about biology or the nature of taxonomy colour our engagement with issues about the moral status of animals?
Good, thanks for that too. These are all very helpful questions. I think they do a lot. I think there's a pervasive misapprehension that there's a kind of species essence that's definitely not phenotypical. And I don't know whether people think it's genotypical, if that's the right word, or what. I know Catholics have a notion here that they, where there's this kind of very theological notion that's somehow or other joined with biology, where they claim that there is, in the way that the human organism is, or whatever it is, or, I mean, I think they beg that question, and say the human organism at the zygote stage or something, the way that it is organized, the way that the matter is organized, so that it's going to take a certain developmental course, constitutes the form in relation to the matter. So again, it's Catholicism appealing to Aristotelianism, producing a kind of hylomorphic notion of the soul as the thing that's infusing and informing the development of the physical matter into the person. And they want to say that whenever there's that kind of form of organization, that kind of telos or whatever, you have there already, not just incipiently, but right there, you have rational capacity. That's actually what the dominant claim in among contemporary Catholic philosophers who write about these issues. And I just can't make any sense of that notion. I'm sorry. I mean, I just don't know what it means. I can imagine a zygote that's clearly human, that's just sort of missing the genes that code for the growth of the brain, and then I just can't see any sense in which that thing is on track for rational capacity or whatever, or has anything that I would consider the form of a being with rational capacity or whatever. It just seems to me that it is a matter of biology. What's going to happen to this thing, what kind of potential it has, what kind of capacity it has, we can kind of find out by looking at the hardware there. And that there's no kind of essence there that's going to guarantee that all entities that are biologically members of the human species have any kind of capacity for higher cognition or whatever. So I guess I just think it's imaginary if people think that there is this, that biology kind of coincides with our nature as members of a certain species coincides with our nature as rational animals or something like that.
Rafael?
Yeah.
Is this
a contemporary question about passage in your presentation where you heard about norms for what we consider to be the cognitive capacities and also the capacity of being or shifting norms. And then we referred back to early modern man and the Homo sapiens. And then we were saying that we don't think that they would be capable of enjoying art the same way, or
Yeah, I wanted to say that I think that our remote human ancestors, you know, the earliest human beings, probably had psychological capacities quite comparable to those of higher non-human animals today, rather, or closer to those than to ours. Yeah.
Do you really mean that? I mean, do you think that if we could, by magic, just get a newborn baby from this Homo sapiens and let it grow here amongst us, don't you think that it would be perfectly comparable to us in these capacities?
No, I don't think that, but I'm ready to be corrected on that by those scientists, whoever they are, who can tell me something about the nature of the earliest of our ancestors who would count as members of the species Homo sapiens. So, I mean, but then, of course, the question arises, for me, anyway, I'm asking now about our earliest human ancestors. So if we were to get a newborn baby from one of them and send it in the time machine to now and raise it in our society now, and if lo and behold it would be a normal functioning person in our society, then I think the same thing absolutely must be true of the baby of a non-human being of two or three generations back. Okay? So I know it's artificial to say this, but if there's some kind of line here, and we say, okay, here are our earliest ancestors, and if we took one of their babies and brought it through a time machine to now, and it would be a perfectly normal human being, then about three or four generations back here, we'd have something that's clearly non-human. You know, it's the non-human ancestor of the first human beings. Surely, if we took one of its babies, the same would have to be true, because the changes are very slow and gradual. So there's something funny here. And that's one of the kind of a priori reasons I have for thinking that it must be the case that the very earliest human beings, if we brought their babies into our world now and raised them, they wouldn't be like us. They'd be like chimpanzees.
We've kind of radically run over time, so I'm sorry I have to cut this off. And I'm sorry for those people who haven't had a chance to ask questions. Jeff may be around.
Yeah, I'll stick around.
So thank you very much for a very stimulating piece.